And we're on.
This is Regina Kong with the Hobbit Hole Oral History Project. I'm with Greg Strebler on July 11th, 2019, at Carolyn Elder's home in Gustavus. So could we start just by having you restate your name and telling me a little bit about where you were born?
Okay. My name is Greg Strebler, and I was born in 1941 in southern Wisconsin. And lived virtually all of my younger years in the state of Wisconsin in farm country. And moved to Alaska, first of all in the summertime in 1962, and then permanently in 66.
What did your parents do?
My dad was a jack of all trades in our little community. He was a plumber, an electrician, and a heating guy. And we lived in the middle of farm country, and so I worked with him when he needed me, and otherwise I worked for farmers. So basically a farm life.
And you had siblings?
Two kids. My daughter Kathy lives in Gustavus, and my son lives in Phoenix. And he's a businessman in Phoenix, and my daughter is, I guess you'd call her a businesswoman. Here she has many hats she wears, but she has run a couple of businesses in Gustavus, and she also works for a Native corporation up in the interior as a chemist and a project manager on remote site cleanup, cleaning up after the Army, stuff like that.
And did you have siblings growing up?
Say that again?
Did you have siblings?
Yes, I had two sisters and a brother, still do. And my brother is a professor of cybernetics at the University of Hawaii, and my sister is a professor of psychiatry at Purdue. And my other sister is a retired information specialist from Los Alamos Lab. Mm. So that's being brief with my family.
And so what brought you to Alaska?
To begin with, basically, ability to work hard. I was just sort of a gopher on an expedition. They needed somebody that could dig holes and skin critters and stuff like that. And so I got on because I was a handy person. And my first trip was to the Aleutian Islands on a joint anthropology-zoology expedition to the Aleutian Islands. And when I saw Alaska, I figured out that one way or another, I had to live here.
What was your first impression of Alaska, do you remember? Mm-hmm.
My training was in geology and ecology, and the first thing I noticed is that all the trees were still on the stump, and all the ecosystems were still working, and I thought, boy, wouldn't I love to live in a place like that? That was my first thought. And it's still my thought.
And where, do you remember where that was?
Well, I first noticed it. A couple of my buddies and I got in this old VW Beetle and we drove the Alaska Highway. And as soon as we left southern Canada, I realized, holy Judas, this place is wild, you know. And so you go thousands upon thousands of miles and there's a few people here and there and just critters and trees. And so by the time I got to Alaska already, I could see, wow. And then I got into a plane, went to the Aleutian Islands. It was like the end of the world in those days. Nobody was out there. We got out in this little remote Aleut village, and there was a Caucasian sheep ranching family, and everybody else was Onongan, as they call themselves, and spoke some English, some native language, and lived pretty much hand-to-mouth, and I thought, well, isn't this cool that there are people that still live that way? But I didn't end up having a chance to live in the Aleutians. There's almost no work out there. But I came back, and I was between my junior and senior years, and like I say, I was just a gopher then. And but then 2 years later, I was getting my master's degree, and I had my own project on ecology, and had a chance to go to Kodiak Island. It was an expedition, and then I had my own project. And so my next summer in Alaska was on Kodiak. And I realized, wow, now I could live here. So then when I graduated with my master's degree a year later, I looked around for work and found a job for the Fish and Game Department in Petersburg, Alaska, which, you know where that is, south of us? It's about 100 miles south of Juneau, a Norwegian fishing community. And stayed there for a year working for Fish and Game as a temporary. But that job was only for a year, so I had to find something else to do. And was able to, in those days, just about every federal official in Southeast Alaska was in Juneau, in the federal building there. And I was just sort of casting around for what there was. And ran into the superintendent of Glacier Bay, and he said, I'm looking for a guy just with your qualifications. Maybe I'll hire you. And in those days, totally different than now, the superintendent could pretty much hire you off the streets if he wanted you. Now you got to go through all sorts of rigmarole to get on registers and get trained and stuff like that. But in those days, he could just say, you're it. And so then after he hired me, I went down to Albright Training Academy in Grand Canyon for 3 months and got my ranger credentials and stuff, and moved back to Glacier Bay, and I've been here ever since. That was late 1966. So I worked for the federal government until 1980, and then I got a little too independent to work for the government anymore, so I went on my own. Started my own business eventually. It took me about 3 years to find a niche, but I became an ecological and geological consultant where I did field studies on various projects and also some teaching. And then I did that till I retired a few years ago. That's it.
I'm curious what the training is like to become a ranger.
Pretty eclectic. In those days, the concept of ranger was very broad. It was partially law enforcement, but it was also partially visitor contact and sort of resource management. So it was everywhere from learning how to shoot a sidearm to how to put handcuffs on people to how to survey wildlife and how to make an evening program for people at the lodge. And it's pretty broad. Mm-hmm. The Park Service was, as government in general, was much more ad hoc than those days than it is now. Much less compartmentalized. Which was a good thing, because when I came from Glacier Bay, like now they have about 100 employees. There were like middle of winter, the first year in Glacier Bay, there were, I think, 9 of us. So, very small staff, and you did whatever had to be done. Didn't what matter. The superintendent told me when I got hired, he said, have you read your job description? I said, yeah, certainly. And he said, well, ignore that. You're here to do what's to be done.
So what did a day look like for you? I guess it varied, but...
Very varied. It could be shoveling snow off the dock if the dock was trying to sink. It could be fixing a patrol boat. It could be making an evening program. It could be building a nature trail. It could be on the outer coast in a skiff to contact fishermen out there to remind them they were in a park. Whatever needed. And the beauty of it was that if you demonstrated capabilities, the superintendent was of a mind that he said, as long as you can tell me with a straight face you did a good job on this and you can show me that you did, you keep doing it. My boss was the chief ranger and the maintenance supervisor, and the two of them would get together every day and figure what's to be done, and then they would allocate resources to that, and I was one of their resources. Did what you had to do.
Did you find your work fulfilling?
Absolutely. I loved it. But as time went on, it changed, and I changed, and I got a little bit more of my personal feet under me here, and was building sort of a subsistence lifestyle over here, a house that I was building. And the government was also changing a lot. And so I just thought when my midlife crisis came along, it was time to go be myself.
So. Do you think that this subsistence lifestyle is something that attracted you from a young age?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was born in an era of family farms where just about everybody in our neighborhood, including the people I work for, were people that had either they or their father had built a farm out of a 160 acres they got for the government as a homestead. And they built their barns and they built their houses and they raised their kids. And in those days, it wasn't you just didn't grow soybeans and corn and then go to the store. In those days, you grew a little bit of everything. And so when times were tough, which they were when I was a kid, because farming was going into a big recession when I was a young man, and nobody went hungry. There was always good stuff to eat. We ate like kings, even when everybody had no money.
What were some things that you remember eating?
Well, to begin with, when I was 12 years old, my dad put me in charge of the garden. And of course, as a kid, I hated that, but as I got older, I realized there was a lot of pride in this, that I was helping the family feed their face, you know, so that was pretty cool. And then we had, my dad, as I say, it was hard times, hard times in the countryside, and so he wasn't always getting paid very well, but he would always always have all the produce he wanted. People would give him, like you'd say, we're butchering a cow next Saturday, you come and take all the meat you want, you know, or whatever. And a lot of times that would work out. My dad would say, well, Greg, Saturday Joe Bauer is butchering, and before you go play baseball that evening, I want you to go over and help, and you bring a quarter of beef back with you. You know, so I learned real early how to handle animals. And I worked on farms doing all kinds of menial work. And so I knew to work hard, and I knew how to take care of animals. I knew how to process them. I knew how to grow stuff, and so it was just, by the time I got here, it was just in my nature. And you may or may not have been told, but early Gustavus, at least Caucasian Gustavus, was pretty much built around farming. It was one of the few pieces of open flat country in southeast Alaska, and the first people here were homesteaders. So they were not the usual in southeast, they were fishermen and loggers or something, but here it was people trying to grow stuff. And so when I got here, that was still going on some, and I realized, wow, this is a great place to grow stuff, you know. So the first thing I did was look for a piece of land to buy, and I started putting a house up, but before the house was even founded, I was already putting a garden in, and been ever since.
What sort of plants do well here?
Well, most root crops. Our staff of life for the winter time are like potatoes and carrots and parsnips and beets, stuff like that, rutabagas. In the summertime, we grow lots of peas, lots of cucumbers. I have a greenhouse, so we have cucumbers and tomatoes and basil and stuff like that in the greenhouse. And then a lot of greens, especially sort of the semi-perennial greens like kale, stuff like that. And we found out pretty quick that you could hold kale right into February. You could just dig it out from under the snow and eat it. It was just as good as in August. So our goal has always been to try to feed ourselves as much as we can from what we grow, or fish or game or something like that.
And how much are you able to do that?
Well, it's a very satisfying life to me. You know, I guess my goal has, from an early age, I guess starting when my dad put me in charge of the garden, was at first I just thought, well, it's to to keep food on the table, which it is, but also the more I got to be ecologically in tune, I realized that the more you live off the stuff that you have, that you pay the ecological cost for, that you have some chance of living a life that the earth might be able to put up with. That instead of buying a set of chicken breasts under cellophane, you want chicken, you raise a chicken, and you know where that came from, and you know what that the environment paid some to raise that chicken, and so you learn pretty quick to sort of tally the ecological cost of what you ate that day. And that remains one of the cornerstones in my life, is to try to understand and minimize, well, put it this way, to try to bear the ecological cost, but only ask of the world the amount of cost that's necessary to lead a joyful life, and no more than that. Because my belief is that we're asking way too much of the world right now, and I don't want to participate in that if I don't have to. So that's kind of the founding idea.
Do you think this is something, or for people living in urban places, how do you think that they can sort of get that sort of same satisfaction if you're living in a place that's not as closely tied to the land?
Mm-hmm. It's a lot harder, but I admire people that move that far, that direction, as far as they can. One of the considerable worries I have for the world is the degree to which we're becoming urbanized, and I think it makes it harder and harder, because there really is, I don't think, any complete substitute for getting up in the morning and being surrounded by an ecosystem that's working, because it just sort of becomes part of your gestalt. But people, I admire very much people that do their best in what I consider difficult circumstances by trying to pay as much attention as you can to what you eat and where it comes from, and what you buy and where it comes from. But in the city, I think you have a lot less control over that. Not that we have perfect control here by any means. We eat a lot of stuff that's shipped up. Every bit of clothes I got on, I didn't make myself. And maybe some sweatshop in Taiwan or somewhere. And I'm sure if I looked at that, it wouldn't be pretty. But I can come a little closer here. But just one more philosophic statement. I won't launch onto that unless that's what you want to talk about. But I think that if our world is going to succeed in your generation, we all have to start really internalizing one word, limits. We can't keep asking the world for everything we want. We have to ask the world for what we need, and then slow down after that. Or with coming on 9 or 10 billion of us, there's no way the world can support us. We're just simply going to have to learn to back down. And here it's a little bit more feasible than it is, say, in Palo Alto or something like that.
Have there been certain experiences in your life, or books you've read, or movies that have brought you to this perspective?
Yeah, I read all the time, and of course a lot of things from books inform me, but I think the fundamental thing is being surrounded by a piece of property that statistically is possible for a wolf to show up outside my window in the morning. Which says to me, if the top carnivores are here, the system is working. And just being part of that system, like this, to grow a garden in Gustavus, you have to put a fence to keep the moose out. You have to put up electric fence to keep the porcupines out. You have to put traps in the garden to keep the voles out. You have to work to keep the slugs out. You have to work to keep the root maggots out. And so I'm very, very, very aware that I'm surrounded by an ecosystem, but I'm also being a major drain on that ecosystem, that every carrot I grew is in a place a moose can never graze. And a mouse cannot be tolerated. And so I'm extremely aware of the beauty of that carrot I ate, and I'm also, every time I take a bite of it, I'm aware of what I cost the world to eat that. And you can't do that when you buy it from a supermarket. There's just not that visceral connection. You know, there can be an intellectual connection, but not a visceral one. And to me, it's the visceral one that's mattered the most, although I read voraciously about all aspects of the modern world and the fast world. I'm sort of an antiquarian by nature. Being a geologist, you're always thinking about the past. But I think it's the visceral stuff that matters the most.
And is this something that you've tried to impart in your own children?
Sure. But you learn fast enough. I don't imagine you got kids yet, do you?
Mm-hmm.
No. And if you do have kids, you will find very quickly that you can have your ideas and you can tell your kids what your ideas are, but the very great likelihood is they're going to have their own ideas. And you got to let that go, you know? Like my daughter lives fairly close to what I believe, but not with some pretty major exceptions. And my son has picked an entirely different life. He's a thoroughly urban guy and works for a big company in the north part of Phoenix. So he has chosen a very different way to live and sort of a different set of lifestyle values. But he and I love each other dearly, and our connection is our human values, because he's a deeply humanistic person. But one learns to let one's kids go and, you know, find their niche in the world and find out what suits them. So, you ever read the book The Little Prince?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kind of that sort of thing. What is there? There's, you can be the bow and you can shoot the arrow, but the arrow will go where it will, you know?
So you raised your kids in Gustavus?
Mm-hmm. My daughter was 2 when I moved here, and my son was born here.
So tell me some more about the natural history. So first of all, a question. Why is Gustavus so flat?
Gustavus is flat because it's a river outwash plain, and it was built about 250 years ago, and its final stage was built 250 years ago when the glacier surged down Glacier Bay and a big river burst out the side of it. Actually, 3 rivers, 2 major ones, and covered a mud flat with the sand you see out here.
And how long ago was that?
About 250 years ago is when the glacier stopped doing it. And then the glacier backed up, the rivers went extinct, they came out of the ice, and the place started vegetating. So everything you see around is young. And then also, the very spot you're sitting was also under ocean by that time, because when the glacier roared down Glacier Bay, it depressed the landscape, and kind of like sitting on a waterbed. And so the ocean came in quite a ways north of us here. And then when the glacier backed off, rather catastrophically, the land started to rise, and the land then extended seaward. And so the land you're sitting on here came out of the water about 100 years ago.
Hmm.
There's no tree around you here that's older than that.
So, and when did people start living here?
Native people, this was a tough place in the early days, and that no Native people lived here permanently, but there were, very soon after the glacier left, there were already fish populating the streams, and they started establishing smokehouses along the major river, which is called the Salmon River out here. I don't think anybody can give me a date. They left Glacier Bay in the 1770s, 1780s, driven out by the ice, and then they were gone quite a while, but then probably 7,500 years later they started coming back, but just as a sort of a seasonal, into only during the best time of year and only when the fish were running, but their villages were elsewhere. And so then the first non-native people came about 1915. They were homesteaders. Three just married couples, actually, stayed the winter. And they didn't like it very much, and they all ended up pregnant after the winter, so they all went somewhere else, and I don't think they ever came back. But I think the first homesteaders were 1921 that actually stuck. That was a big family by the name of Parker came. And Toshua Parker, the guy that runs Toshco, the big store here, is a great grandson of those people.
Oh, wow.
So then Gustavus got to be pretty well known as a possible. In those days, if you had come here in 1921, none of these trees were here. The whole South Africa Gustavus was a big meadow. And so it's just a wonderful grazing country, and people started raising beef cattle right away. And also a pretty good place to, no trees to get out of the way. You just plow it up and put some kelp in it for fertilizer, and you got a garden, you know. So a couple of the families started raising garden produce to sell to the canneries in the summertime, and they sold beef to the canneries and to places like Juneau. And that pretty much all ended during the Second World War. And that's when the airport was built, and you might say heavy industry moved in for that. The roads were the big paved road was built then, and at about that time and after that time, technology changed so much that, like, there were freezer ships and stuff like that that came up from Seattle, and nobody here could compete with the produce and beef that was sent up from Seattle, so it pretty much quickly died and became just a subsistence place. And Gustavus went into a real tailspin after that, and almost depopulated. By middle of 1950s, there was just a few families that ran the government installation. The park didn't exist then as an installation at all, and Bartlett Cove was still a wilderness. And there were a few families that came in to run the airport and the associated facilities. And there were a few of the die-hard homesteaders that held out, but probably altogether there were less than 100 people here then. And it was just a little bit after that that I came. And the thing that changed that was that in the middle 60s, the Park Service put an installation in at Bartlett Cove, and there was work for building that, and there were they needed a few people to work there permanently. And it was just a time that people like me, young folks that sort of back to the land type people, found Gustavus pretty cool, and half a dozen families like mine moved in. And so then it started going back up again. And nowadays, well, you've talked to people about the present economy and stuff like that, I'm sure, right?
I don't know. What were you going
to
say about
that? Well, is any of this germane to you? Where would you like me to, you know, I can blabber to you all day, but what is it you want to hear?
I guess I want to ask you a few questions about the sort of geology of the Hobbit Hole.
Yeah.
And so why does it look the way it does, and mm-hmm. what were the natural processes that shaped it?
So you've been there for a while, right? How long were you there?
Since June 13th.
Yeah. So you've walked around to look at rocks and stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know any rock talk?
I know there are three types.
Okay.
Igneous, metamorphic, and sedimentary.
And what do you mostly see there?
It looks like, I'm going to say metamorphic.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the Hobbit Hole is part of a major, what's called a suture zone, a place where two crustal plates have come together and all mashed together and done this kind of stuff. Downwarped, upthrown, fractured, cooked. So the rocks are highly, highly altered. Some of them almost melted. They're very tough. And you notice that there, the Indian Eyes sit right in the middle of Cross Sound, right? And Icy Strait is upstream from them. So, did Zach or anybody there talk to you about the glacial history of that area? Mm-mm. So, during the height of the last Great Ice Age, about 20,000 years ago, those islands were covered by something like close to 2,000 feet of ice. And that ice extended way out to the ocean, like 10 or 12 miles at least off of Cape Spencer there, way out. And so these islands were in, if you think about all the ice that came from all the way from Skagway and all the way from Juneau and all the way down to Petersburg, almost all that ice was funneled right through there. And so it was like, if you imagine Southeast Alaska being the tube of toothpaste, and that's the nozzle, and all that stuff is squirted out right there. And so, like, there's a lot of deep holes in Icy Strait and a lot of deep holes just past the Indian Eyes, but they stand right in the middle of it. And they were so tough, they stood against the ice and became above water feature. So the rock is extremely resistant to erosion. And so just imagine that it's just like a fist standing against a stream. And for thousands of years, that ice is going out of there and nailing it from the front end and piling over the top of it. And it stood its ground all that time. So it's a very, very tough piece of rock. And on either sides of it, there were fault lines, so the ice was able to excavate the rock out there and dig North Pass and South Pass and stuff like that, and then dig the hole that is now Cross Sound. So that's kind of, so in a few words, the rock started out a long time ago by being a mishmash of rocks between two crustal plates that got really, really beat up and really cooked and made into something very resistant. And then the Ice Age ended up rounding it off into a big knob that has holes on either side of it, or straits on either side of it, that could be cut down to a below sea level. And so you've got this big fist just sitting right in the middle of Cross Sound. And that has had, not only does that give terrestrial critters and plants a place to live in the middle of all that, but it's also very important for marine critters, so that you've got just about every fish that has to come in the northern and southeast Alaska has to come right by those islands. There's no way to get around it. And so it's everything gets concentrated there. So that's why you see all the critters you see around there, why the sea lions just love it, and why there's whales around and sea otters everywhere and stuff like that, because there's so much concentrated life there. And for that same reason, it's always been important to people. Paul Johnson probably told you about the seine fishery that used to exist out there. Did he talk to you about that?
Not much.
So one of the main ways to catch salmon in Alaska is called seine fishing. There's three ways. You can catch them with a gill net. You can catch them with a hook and line, like, say, the Howe brothers did. Or you can catch them with a seine, which is a big net that's, the mesh is too small for the fish to get out of, and you take a great big piece of it and you make a semicircle out of it, and you have a boat on either end, and then you keep going and you bring it together. It's called a purse seine, because you purse it, make it into a purse. And then if you've done it right, you got a whole school of salmon caught stuck in the net, and then you just pull it up and throw them in the boat. And so it was because there was so many fish there, but at the same time, because of all the currents, because of the fact that it's all narrowed down and the currents are so strong, it was a very hard place to fish, but an extremely rewarding place to fish. And the Huna people became real masters at that. And one of the great disasters for them was when the Fish and Game Department closed that fishery, because they lost that claim to fame there, and they had it was a source of great prestige and also great wealth that they had that fishery, and they were among the few people that figured out to do it without wrecking your boats and wrecking your nets and stuff. So that when that fishery stopped, and Fish and Game had good biological reasons to do it, it made a great, great difference to the Huna people as to what the Indian Islands meant to them. And so they weren't around very much after that. And as a matter of fact, some Caucasian people took up the private land that Zach's operation is based on now, and had a fox farm on it, and had otherwise just lived there and fished off from it. But I think there was a great turning point at that point from to where the Indian Islands, I don't think the native people lived there, although they had camps on it and stuff, but the islands and its surroundings were very, very important to the Huna Kwan, the people that lived in the general area. So they kind of went away after that. But the area has great significance to them. You've probably heard some of the, maybe Wayne has told you some of the oral history of the various heroic things that happened there, and the various salient happenstances that ingrained the place into their minds. But really, I don't think they were very involved in the Indian Islands as a place after the net fishery stopped.
Could you explain what does that mean? So first of all, what is a fishery, and what is the significance of that?
Yeah. So salmon have always been the staff of life for native people around here, right? Their first bite just to eat for themselves, but then also it was a great source of pride and source of income for them when people started establishing canneries and salteries and that sort of thing. And so they became expert fishermen, mechanized fishermen, pretty early on, and became very important in the fishery because of their abilities with it. So every summer when the fish came back, one of the first reasons that Caucasian people got interested in the country. Well, first it was the Russians, right, that came and were interested in the fur bearers. But then when the Russians got bought out and the fur industry basically was exterminated by the overuse, there was a little bit of still fur hunting from like Boston and places like that, but very radically that declined by the early 1800s, and well, let's see, it was 1850s that it became America, so let's start with that. So by the time Americans owned it, the main thing people were interested in here were the fish. And mostly the way they took care of the fish was to can them. At very first, they salted them. Was hard to do in bulk. It was hard to find enough salt. And so pretty quickly when the technology came along for canning, they jumped on that. And so all the fishing basically was done to can things in. And the way you caught fish in bulk was either to build what they called fish traps, and there's a whole book on fish traps that written by a local guy if you want to read about that, but you would just set a great big net system up in the current and the fish would catch themselves, basically. Or you caught them with a net, and the Tlingit people were masters at catching them with nets, it turned out. And so now that gets us to the Indian Islands and the net fishery there, because the fish are so concentrated and hard. It was very rewarding to catch them in a concentrated place, but very hard. and they became masters at that. And so the Indian Islands area became very important in the context of the fishery because of that.
So a fishery is just an area where there are a lot of fish?
Fishery means just a way to catch fish.
Oh, okay.
And basically a way to catch fish was largely involving nets in those days, and they were masters at that. So, and bear in mind that catching fish was basically the only reason that people were coming up here. The native people had to adapt to that, and they did. And actually with quite a bit of pride. They were among, I think, of the few of the native groups in North America that managed to kind of hold on to a lot of their life and a lot of their self-pride, because they could found a way rather quickly to adapt to what was becoming lucrative. And the Indian Islands were kind of a jewel in their crown there for a while. So when that jewel went away, it was pretty depressing for Huna. And my expression, I think, as best as I know, there wasn't much native use around the islands for quite a while. But this is one of the things that Zach has done that is quite wonderful, and that is that he has made a big point of drawing the native people's attention back there and opening up the chance for them to exercise their pride there again.
You said that the Indian Islands have special importance for them. Mm-hmm. In what ways, well, besides the being a center for their fishing?
Well, any place, have you learned anything about their culture here?
Not much, no.
Okay. Their religion, I don't know they would call it their religion, but their way of looking at the world was animist. They had, when places mattered to them, and mostly if it mattered, it was because it kept them alive, they would invest those places with particular spirits and particular stories. As a matter of fact, more than I've ever read anywhere else, the people in Southeast Alaska place immense stock in stories. They're like their deeds to the countryside. I'll give you an example. There used to be a clan house at the point between the mouth of Glacier Bay and Icy Strait, a place called Point Gustavus now. It used to have a clan house on it. And that clan house was owned by a particular group of the Tlingit people. And the way they illustrated their ownership, of course their language was not written down, was by the stories there. And one of the key stories was that, if I have this right, I wish Wayne was here, but A young Tlingit man was accused of a very serious transgression. I think it had to do with killing somebody. And a delegation from the aggrieved people came ashore there when he and his uncle were there and demanded an eye for an eye. And the uncle said, "Well, you have the right to ask that. But take me." And they did. And I don't know if they enslaved him or killed him or what, but he became their property. And that consecrated that spot to this tribe. And that was part of their deed to that property, was the story that went along with that. And so there are stories like that. There's a place, did you hear about a place there called The Laundry?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's, if you come, did you kayak out there or anything?
No.
So if you go out around the corner of The Laundry, there's a face that if you look at just in a certain spot, looks just like a rock cliff, just like a human face. And there's a story about a person that got set into stone there. And there's also a story about right there about a Tlingit strong man that fought a giant octopus there. And so those stories again become part of the deed to that place.
The giant octopus is something that I've heard about. It's kind of related to the Hobbit Hole area. Mm-hmm.
And it's invested in, so by proxy, the Hobbit Hole becomes part of it. So that when you have, and this, of course, was contested among the native groups, just like it is among white people with deed claims and stuff, and that is it. So you have this thing that happened on this one spot, the guy fights the octopus. So then the question is, how far does that deed go, you know? And then that's where sometimes it even comes down to fisticuffs or warfare, you know, to figure out where does that deed start. Stop, and then where does somebody else's claim start, you know? And that all had, there was, Tlingit politics are very intricate about something like that. But it begins with heroic events or notable events and stories that everybody agrees, we own this story and therefore we own this place. Like when the native people were forced out of Glacier Bay by the ice. There's a tremendous story that goes with that. And there's a tremendous story that goes with just as they were forced to leave, the last Tlingit headman that left, he had the canoe stop off Pleasant Island, and he composed a song of sorrow about losing his home. And that spot becomes consecrated by him doing that. And so then their ownership of Pleasant Island is in part related to that. And their ownership of the Southern Glacier Bay is based on the stories of what happened as the ice came down. So it's a different way of looking at land tenure, but they were definitely, one of the reasons Tlingit people did well when the Caucasian world showed up here was that they had a system of land rights. And they had a system of ownership and stuff like that, where a lot of other native folks was just all communal ownership. But they had a system that was at least sort of homologous with ours. And it allowed them to kind of work into the upcoming, the burgeoning new system with a little bit more ease than people that have a totally different way of looking at the world. But they lost a lot of their country because you can imagine. So the white folks come and they stake a claim on Hobbit Hole. They're going to put a fox farm there, right? Well, the native people had a deed to it. But they no longer had the power to enforce that deed. And so the white people said, deed? What deed? Show me. You know, it's just a goddamn story. Well, I got a piece of paper. And this is what the Great Father says is what is real, so we'll see you guys, you know. And that happened all over Southeast with various sorts of claims, not the least of which was Glacier Bay National Park itself. So the Native people entered an era of a great erosion, a great denial of their rights, denials of their hegemony in the country, and they had learned to just fit in a niche somewhere. And one of those niches was their seine fishery, and then they lost that.
So what did they do after that?
Who knows, a pretty depressed place for a long time. Native people in general, you might have read the statistics about alcoholism and suicide and all that stuff in native populations around the world, really. Because you eviscerate their pride and their sense of self, and then what have they got left? And then especially if they lose such things that held their pride together, like this fishery I was telling you about. It was very tough. When I first moved here, the Huna was in very hard shape. But then the native people didn't take it all laying down either. Some of them became very highly educated. There was a native guy whose last name was Paul, P-A-U-L, who became a very prominent lawyer. And he got a bunch of people together, very smart people, and they value education. It used to be education elders to kids and stuff, but they ended up buying into the Presbyterian way of education and stuff too, and became pretty savvy. Some of them became quite savvy in the white man's world, and they started quite a long time ago pushing for Native rights. And long story short, about 30 years ago, they managed to get a major, called Native Land Claims Act, passed the U.S. Congress for all of Alaska Natives, which gave them 40 million acres and $1 billion of restitution and money. And they used that money to set up corporations and get businesses going and set up heritage institutes and stuff like that. They set up their own sort of welfare system, things like that. They start picking the pieces up. And I think they're in a lot better shape today than they were when I came.
Are they still fishing?
Mm-hmm. But fishing is not the major staff that it was. Actually, if you go to Hunanau, they built a great big cruise ship dock and a great big place called Icy Strait Point, which is just sort of like a big amusement park for the cruise ships that's mm-hmm. based on Native heritage and things. And also the one of the world's longest zip lines. How about that? They've got so a combination of Tinseltown and Native history and heritage. And they make a lot of money off it. It's one of the major ports in Southeast now for the big cruise ships.
I have to try to take a trip out there. So when did your involvement with the Hobbit Hole begin?
Mine?
Mm-hmm.
Well, pretty much right when I got here, the superintendent, the Hollis dad, was a dyed-in-the-wool personal fisherman, and he went out there, he got his own boat, and I went with him sometimes, and it was just, it was owned by some old-timers there then that were looking to sell, and the Howboys were interested in buying it. They were just basically 20-year-old, 20-something guys then, and Bob grubstaked them. They bought the place. And so I was friends with the Howes, and of course Bob was my boss, and so and I knew the boys well, so I'd go out there quite a bit. And it was just a bunch of old tumble-down buildings and stuff like that then. But, that's when it started. And I never had a lot to do with it in any really substantive way. It was just sort of a cool place to go once in a while.
What was your first impression of the Hobbit Hole?
As an ecologist and geologist, an extremely exciting place, biotically and geologically. I always love to go there and look things over and try to puzzle out what the rocks you can see. I'm sure just looking around, even if you're a non-geologist, you can see how complicated it is. It's every place you look at rocks different, and it's so cool to try to figure that out. And like with all that life siphoning by there, it's so cool. And the woods are complicated, and so just in those days, I was a young scientist just absorbing everything I could, and it was just one of the sort of the hot spots around. So every time I got a chance, I'd go out there and I'd just try to figure stuff out.
Could you describe some of your favorite things to look at? And why they were interesting to you?
Because of the diversity, because of the incredible abundance. And as I mentioned to you before, in a slightly different context, There was something sort of inherently powerful about islands that could stand up. When I figured out the power that the ice had exerted on that spot and how that rock had still got stood up to it, it was just like it was just an inherently powerful place to me. I could just feel that rock standing up to the ice for thousands of years, and it just sort of a subliminal feeling there of power. And then all the Stream of Life Pass, it was another very vivid, powerful thing. So, when I first came, I was very taken with an author by the name of Carlos Castaneda, who came from right down where you were. He was, I forget which of the campuses he was going to then. One of the California campuses. You running out?
No, it's good.
He was an anthropologist student. Mexican heritage. He was studying the Yaqui Indians down in northern Sonora, I think it was. And ran across, nobody knows for sure, he's very clever about this, nobody knows for sure if this is real or contrived, but this is how the story goes, that he meets this Yaqui sorcerer named Don Juan. And one of the things, Don Juan had many things to tell him, but one of the things that stuck in my mind, and has the Navajo come back to that, is that Don Juan said that two things. That everything that really matters, you only see out of the corner of your eye. And if you look at it, it goes away. In other words, everything that really matters is kind of ineffable. And the second thing he said was that a landscape has a geographic topography, but it also has a psychic topography. And just like some landscapes that have mountains on them and stuff like that, and deep valleys, a landscape has psychic highs and lows. And some places that have a particularly high psychic geography, he called power spots. And I thought the Indian Islands and Cross Sound were power spots. I really like that metaphor.
I like that too.
So maybe that's a way to summarize my feeling.
And have there been any other places you've been that have had that same feeling for you?
Oh yeah, there's other power spots for sure. But it's a good one.
So what were your thoughts when, or how did you feel when Zach proposed this idea of buying the property from the house and making it into an experiential field school?
Well, I was kind of aghast to begin with. I thought, what the hell? You're going to buy a $2 million property? What? You're basically finding a way to feed your face right now. And look what he's done. Being not a person that has any skill at all raising money, I was just thought, Zach, you're cruising for a bruise in here. Are you sure you want to get into this? And fortunately, I didn't say that aloud. But I supported him best I could. But I thought, there's not a chance of a snowball in hell you're going to pull this off. But go for it, you know? And he has. You spent some time around Zach. You know the power of his psyche. And his ability, well, the fact that you're doing what you're doing, I'm doing what I'm doing right this minute, is a testimony to, Zach has this uncanny power to parasitize everybody's energy and put it toward what his dream. He's very good at that, isn't he? Why are you here? Uh-huh. And I admire it deeply. You have to kind of watch it, and I'll admonish you this way. Watch it, because he can work you pretty darn hard, and you'll wonder how you got into it. But I know my limits, and I stick with them, but I help him all I can, because his dream is beautiful, and it's very powerful, very needed in this world.
What's been your relationship with Zach?
My relationship with Zach is that his mom and my former wife are sisters. So he's my nephew.
So you've known him since he was a kid?
Yeah. Since he was born. Since he was, before he was born.
To see where he is now. That must be
his mom funny. Came up to Alaska basically because my wife was here, and she was her younger sister, and she came up and got a job at Glacier Bay Lodge, and so the rest is history. So, yeah, I've known Zach since he was a gleam in his dad's eye. But I lost track with him. I mean, Zach had something else to overcome, and that is that he left here almost as a post-adolescent. And his mom and dad were both so serious about education that they cobbled their pennies together and sent him to a very highfalutin place, you know, Pomona College, and then on to Stanford. He was here for most but not all of his high school. And so by the time he was his middle teens, I was losing track of him. And I totally lost. He hardly ever showed up here for years when he was being educated down there. And so in a way, he and I had to become all reacquainted when he came back as a newly minted PhD with all these ideas, you know. But we do pretty well.
Do you mind if we take a few minute break?
Say that again.
Do you mind if we take a little break?
Got it.
Just drink some water and...
No, you... Okay. Well, you heard from Johnson and the Howes. That's the best sources for, like, what happened when it became sort of the young fisherman's hangout. And Greg Howe and Paul Johnson were great buddies when they were teenagers, went to school together, and great bullshit artists and full of energy and did all kinds of cool stuff, you know. And Greg is kind of retired now, but Paul's still kind of a go-getter. Quite a quick character, isn't he? So I can't begin to tell you the stuff that those guys can, so I won't bother. But to think about, like, what's happening now, I'd say it's about 90-95% positive, but there are some little burrs in the back of my mind that tell me there's things to watch for too. And the way life goes in general is that when you have people with, and I put Laura into this too, we haven't talked about Laura at all of it, but she's becoming a pretty integral part of that out there too. But her energy at the moment is kind of more Gustavus, but she's obviously has a big stake out there now. But when you take two people of their power of their vision and their ability to make things happen, and of course Laura's brand new here, and Zach in a sense is kind of newly minted here. People don't know him as an adult yet very much. There's always going to be a certain skepticism and a certain resistance when people start putting a big dream together that is nobody else's dream and just one that's kind of imported. And so one of the roles I hope to play and have been playing is kind of helping run interference on that, since I've been here since the day one, and people know me and by and large trust me, and I can help interpret a little bit. But so I worry about that a little bit, and also that's a pretty important thing with regard to Huna, to have the place revitalized is great for them. And Zach is, I think, doing a great job so far at involving them. But still, there's going to be an unease about, you know, this is a white man's dream. And if we had revitalized it, it wouldn't have been this way. We'd have done something different. So there's always going to be a little bit of unease there. So we'll see how that goes. And Laura's going to run in that big time here in Gustavus with this big new place she bought. And now has to. She's going to have all sorts of heavy-duty things going on there that people are going to scratch their head, what the hell, you know. So there's that ticklish social part that we'll have to see how it goes. But in terms of the basic dream, there's logistic problems. You can imagine I'd recommend sometime if you can afford the time and money to come up here in the middle of the winter sometime. Because you really got to see that to see the rest of it. It's a tough damn piece of country out there in the wintertime. Blows like crazy. Sleeting and snowing all the time.
Do you mean here in Gustavus or Oklahoma?
I mean, well, everywhere in north and southeast, but I'm thinking specifically out there. You've got the Brady Glacier coming down. You've got the ocean coming in. You've got the interior coming this way. You've got all this weather happening right there and all the currents. And logistically, it's a tough damn place. And so logistically, Zach has really got himself in a pickle there. I mean, it's going to be, I'm so glad that Laura's got a big base and they've got this base, because there's going to be a lot of times in the winter when you're just going to be stuck here. And you may want to get to those islands, but you ain't going to. Planes can't fly and it's too much for the boats you got, and you're going to be here. So Gustavus has got to be a base. And that's going to take a lot more thought and a lot more money and more logistics and stuff like that. And Zach is working his way through that, but it's the way to go yet. So there's the ticklish social part, there's the ticklish logistic part that's got to be worked out yet. And then I guess you would say the rest is moving along pretty darn well. It's pretty darn easy to get people interested in, quite high-quality presenters to be involved in what they're doing. He never seems to have trouble finding people like that. And if Zach and Laura can maintain their energy output, which is gargantuan, and if they can keep their money stream together, which is always a trick, I think it's really moving.
Have you been able to interact with any of the student groups or just watch them?
Reframe that a little bit. How would you want me to answer that?
I was wondering what you think when you see all these students coming over to the Hobbit Hole and having this sort of education.
Oh, so what do I think of their educational model?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're stuck with the same dilemma that almost everybody has these days, and that is that's the 1% that's got the money to really make you work. And they're doing their darndest to get by that, and I think about as successfully as one could hope at this point. But I think in the long run, if they want to be free from asking rich people to help them all the time, they're going to have to endow the place one way or the other. That's what I think. But I'm sure you're aware of this, that in our society right now, that one of the great questions is inequality, and how do you deal with that? And anytime you try to do anything like Zach is doing, or Laura, you first have to start out where the money is, because you need money. But you don't want to just be educating rich folks all the time. You want, and they both feel very strongly, you want a whole spectrum of people. And so it's going to be hard. Just the way our society is structured right now, it's money rises to the top, and that's where you go find it. Zach's acutely aware of that, and I'm sure Laura is too. I guess that's what I would say.
Well, I know you have to leave soon, but anything else you want to talk about? Literally anything. Don't worry about what I'm looking for or anything.
Well, it seems to me like we've covered my view of what Zach is doing and what his challenges are, and his educational model. And like, I guess I'd say with one final thing is that my hope for those two people, that they don't take too much of the world on their back. That the world is, from the standpoint of a critter, the world is in a very desperate spot, and going to get more so. In their different ways of being trained, they both are acutely aware of that, and I hope they don't take too much on board. That they don't weigh their psyche down too much with it. And they're aware of that, and they combat it. And I just hope the enormity of the world's problems don't weigh on them too hard, that they allow themselves some simple joys as outside that. My personal feeling is that the way to survive the world at the present time is, in a word, compartmentalization. That you can have a part of your psyche which you take on full force the world's problems and look full force for the world's solutions, but you put sideboards on that so that your joy in life doesn't depend exactly on that part, which is going to be difficult and dark for a while. That there has to be parts of yourself that bring you joy that are not open to erosion from those problems. I hope that for them. I hope it for you.
I want to ask you one last question.
Mm-hmm.
What to you brings you joy? What are the things that bring you joy in your life?
What brings me joy? Trying to find a way to summarize it. Can I spring a little quantum physics on you?
Go for it.
My project this winter was, I try it every winter to have an intellectual project that really pins my feathers back. And this year was deep reading on quantum physics and the general forefront of modern physics. And the two questions that I posed to myself were, number one, what is time? And what are the most fundamental entities of creation? And with regard to the second one, the best I've been able to hypothesize a personal stance on it, if you drill down as deep as modern physics has, and then try to kind of hallucinate a step or two past that, it seems like when you get down to the very basic basis of reality, time, space, matter, energy, all become secondary. What seems to be at the base of everything is information and relationship. And much to my amazement, Those are two pretty good words to describe my joy. I find that I am what I relate to. Whether it be you this moment, whether it be that spruce tree this moment, whether it be my daughter who I love past compare and have for 50 years, whether it be the vole I just trapped in my garden, I define myself by my relationship to the stuff and by, therefore, that's where my joy resides. And information. I can't tell you how much joy I get from trying to understand or trying to see through somebody else's eyes what matters to them. So in an odd way, my lesson from physics is also my lesson about life. How's that for weird?
That is wonderful.
I will stop at that.
Thank you.
Can I ask you?
Yeah.
Is that fair?